Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Drs. Bruce Baker and Preston Green. Dr. Baker is a professor in the Graduate School of Education at Rutgers University, and Dr. Green is the John and Maria Niag Professor of Urban Education at the Niag School at the University of Connecticut. Both are experts in K-12 school finance and school choice policy. Thank you both for being on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Grateful for you having us.
So I want to start by asking you about the Biden administration's proposal to allocate $130 billion of relief funds to K-12 schools. So this is in addition to funds that were already provided through the CARES Act and funds that are being provided to states that should also theoretically support public education as well as higher ed. So what are these new funds designed to do?
Well, I've yet to parse all the details of it, but you know, I've been asked and been discussing this a number of times with the reporters lately. I mean, certainly a part of it is kind of like what happened last time around with trying to mitigate the effects of the economic shock to states and get money out to help kind of stabilize school districts and school system budgets. It's, you know, to my understanding, it's being done a little bit differently on the allocation side, being driven more through Title I this time around, which is actually a good thing. But it's also still short term, and short term propping up of district budgets to fill these holes also requires consideration of kind of second and third phases of this. Big issue that we bumped up against last time with that piece of the puzzle was that the money was there for 2 years, then it was gone. And states had allocated it more significantly to the districts with greater needs, and then they turned around and took it away in more significant amounts from the districts with greater needs. And those districts got much bigger budget hits than other districts that were more able to make up the difference. There may be some differences between the what is and the what should be. And I've seen a lot of attention to this trying to mitigate learning loss and this lost generation thing. And can we pour a bunch of money into tutoring, supplemental services, summer and after school programs? It's still going to be temporary money. We're going to put it there, then it's going to be gone. I'm not sure that that's going to be the most efficient mitigation strategy. It just happens to be responsive to the catchphrases that have been thrown around by DC think tanks. I think, you know, there may be better approaches. Certainly some of the approaches are short term. They're around issues like, you know, cleaning supplies, PPE, preparedness to reopen. But short term money might better be spent on a major capital program, you know, upgrading HVAC and air quality, you know, upgrading systems that then last beyond the duration of the money that went in. A major kind of school facilities renewal program. They talk about, you know, putting money into reducing class size to make classes safer. Well, if there aren't classrooms and safe and clean, well-ventilated classrooms, that's really not going to help. Put a big chunk of federal money into capital, which lasts beyond the duration of the investment of that money. Not only that, but it often then leads to reduced operating costs for the districts after that money is put in.
Yeah, to piggyback on what Bruce has said, I have been very concerned about the short-term spending and the two-year focus on making sure that school districts that are in high poverty do not suffer from loss of funding for the two-year period. I mean, the big concern from looking at the Great Recession, the previous Great Recession, was that those districts were the ones that were affected. And they certainly were affected beyond that two-year period. So there needs to be, in my estimation, greater protection against spending. I also really cringe at the focus on learning loss. Full disclosure, there have been like five people I know whom I grew up with who have died from COVID, who lived in my neighborhood. And so when I hear about focus about learning loss, and I think about some people with whom I grew up with and some other folks from the Black community, from various Black communities I've spoken to, many of them are certainly concerned about making sure that there are greater protections for people to really prevent the spread of COVID in these communities. So I would certainly like to see a greater focus on safety, on ventilation, on making sure that that these communities can have like safe spaces. And I mean, the issues of learning loss are short term. So I think those are certainly issues that I would like to see addressed in more greatly, maybe going down the road.
So you've both already touched on this topic, but how does the COVID-19 federal funds package that's being allocated to schools this time around compare to the package that was offered in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis? And are there any lessons that we can learn from what the federal government did in 2008 that it should or shouldn't do this time around?
Yeah, I think there are more parts to them, right? I mean, they're the additional kind of short-term mitigation strategies, which are focused on, you know, the supplemental programs. But beyond that, you know, the problem, part of the problem is the same. It's, you know, how do we smooth out revenues through an economic shock? And unfortunately, we don't seem to have learned yet. And we even outlined in a policy brief last spring with a big public forum and then a piece in Cap'n in the fall, we outlined, hey, do it in two stages, big boost up front, needs to be general funding, not targeted to teacher salaries or teacher quantity, because different districts face different issues. So, and then there needs to be a second phase, and we can still do that, a second phase to then, because it's a sharp dip followed by a slow climb out, takes like 3 to 5 years at least, right? But in addition to that second phase, then there need to be stricter requirements on states to not just maintain their effort, but restore their effort, ideally to what it was like before the last recession, because states never restored the share of their economic capacity that they were spending on schools in 07-08. We're still not back to there, and now we're taking another hit. So there need to be, you know, some more strict requirements on states to do that. We also lay out in this piece in Phi Delta Kappa last fall in the Kappa magazine that, you know, there needs to be some kind of scrutiny on the fact that states were, you know, the states were pulling back the aid from these programs to fund higher need schools, but they were protecting aid programs that provided tax relief to affluent suburban communities.
One concern about the Great Recession was that it was the high poverty school districts, the high minority school districts that got the bigger cut in funding. And there's certainly the federal government certainly has a toolkit to prevent this from happening this time around. So I hope that the Biden administration considers using its power to guard against policies that create racial funding disparities through Title VI's implementing regulations to ensure that states don't, if they do cut, that they don't cut in ways that are disproportionately harmful to minority school districts. So that is certainly one recommendation that I would have going forward that the Biden administration can enact.
So far we've focused on public funds that are being allocated to schools in the midst of the pandemic, but you've also both spent a considerable amount of time thinking about how public funds are being used to fund private schools. And in particular, you recently co-authored a piece entitled The Post-Espinoza Endgame, where you raise concerns about a recent Supreme Court decision. For listeners who might not be familiar with the case, what was the issue being decided by the Supreme Court, and what, in your view, is most concerning about the decision?
So the Espinoza decision involved a Montana tuition tax credit provision that gave $500 in tax credits to the persons to provide funding that they would then be used to a tuition organization that would then provide vouchers to participating students to attend private schools. The problem here was that Montana has a no aid program, which is which prohibits funding, indirect funding to religious organizations. And this is popularly known as a Blaine Amendment. These were state constitutional provisions that placed greater restrictions on funding than the federal constitution. Now, there have been questions about whether or not the Montana provision was an actual Blaine Amendment. There were other reasons for enacting, you know, for this state constitutional provision, but this is how the Supreme Court treated it. And so what the Supreme Court stated was that if there is a private school choice program, then this Blaine Amendment cannot be used as a reason for restricting or eliminating funding to religious institutions. And what the court said, which is really important, was that the court made this distinction between religiously affiliated institutions and religious use. And what the court said was that there could not be a restriction to religiously affiliated institutions, but it left open the possibility that there could be religious use restrictions in the future. This is also important, though, because there are, Supreme Court justices hinted that they may remove this religious use, religious affiliation restriction in the future. Most notably, Justice Gorsuch made note of this. So I think when people looked at this decision, they felt, okay, we feel comfortable about this. This is not a major movement in the direction of these restrictions. But what we've talked about in our piece about Espinoza is that you really should be looking at religious funding cases as a series of dominoes. And the first domino back in the early 2000s was, does the US Constitution prohibit funding to religious institutions? That was removed in the Zelman case. And then the next question, the Espinoza case addressed, was can state constitutions then prohibit funding to private institutions? State religious Blaine amendments can restrict, and that has been removed. But now we're really at 3.0. We're now at 3.0, which is the question of whether or not there can be any restrictions these religious institutions may engage in a number of activities that we may be concerned with. There may be discrimination for LGBTQ students. There may be issues about curriculum. So what may happen next, I think, is that there's going to be this targeting of this religious use restriction. And if that gets removed, then we could have all kinds of, I think, funding for activities that we're very, very concerned about. And this could also have major impact on fiscal funding or limitations for, public schooling. So what we're really seeing is a position where they're really looking to open funding for a variety of ways, in ways that may even eventually impact on the amount of funding that goes to public school districts. So we really need to be paying attention to this going forward.
Right. And as I understand it, I mean, part of this puzzle, and one of the next dominoes that's already set up in place, is whether or not, so now a state can't have a program that funds private institutions but excludes religious ones. But it appears, at least so far, that a state can have such a program. It includes religious ones, but the state can impose neutral regulations, even if those regulations might impose a burden on a religious practice. That the state could have anti-discrimination regulations. That as of now, that still stands, much in the same way it stood in the handling of student activities organizations in the CLS v. Martinez case, which was Christian Legal Society, was a student organization at Hastings Law School, which is UC Berkeley, public university law school. And the law school adopted an all-comers non-discrimination policy that CLS fought against. But the law school won in that case of being able to exclude CLS from becoming a recognized organization because it would not comply with these religion-neutral non-discrimination policies but non-discrimination policies that were argued to be specifically offensive to certain religious views. We have an analogous case already being brought in Maryland, right, by a Christian school that does not want, that participates in the state voucher program, but does not want to comply with similar regulations. That the question will be, well, will the, is this the case where the court steps in and says, on the one hand, if you fund private schools, you must fund religious ones. And on the other hand, you can't regulate certain practices, even if it appears that you are adopting a religion-neutral regulation, if that religion-neutral regulation offends a particular religion. The other thing that we have going on here is that we've got like a, we've got a fanning out of dominoes actually Justice, was it Breyer's dissent, right? Breyer also pointed out that this public-private distinction is a little dicey. In fact, he says, except in his dissent, he says, accepting the majority's distinction between public and non-public schools does little to address the uncertainty that this holding introduces, the Espinoza holding, that you have to fund, permit religious institutions. And he says, what about charter schools? So Breyer acknowledges, you know, states vary widely in how they permit charter schools to be structured, funded, and controlled, citing Julie Mead's work. Not ours, unfortunately. I wanted the Supreme Court cite on that. But right, this issue that charter schools are, at least in my view, under most state governance structures with, you know, with private management companies, citizen boards of private citizens as their boards of directors, are more analogous to the private schools in Espinoza than they would be to a government-operated school. And we're now back to something Preston wrote about 20 years ago, which was the likelihood that religious operators could not be excluded from running charter schools. And then if the, that next domino falls, they might not be, we might not be able to prohibit them from running charter schools and discriminating against LGBTQ students and so on. Yeah, now this bucket of institutions that might have just been a small subset of religious schools taking vouchers in Montana suddenly becomes, you know, schools that enroll, you know, 10% of kids in Florida in charter schools, or whatever percent of kids in Arizona, you know, which is probably about double that. In states like Florida, where the state has already chosen not to impose any degree of regulatory authority on anti-LGBTQ discrimination in their voucher-receiving schools.
And to piggyback on Bruce's points, a number of, like Nicole Stell Garnett, who is a adjunct fellow of the Manhattan Institute and a professor of law at Notre Dame, has recently written a piece for the Manhattan Institute, basically asserting that, you know, that you could have, that charter schools can be religious and states can't prevent them from teaching religion. And the point about, and the point, as I understand it, about the argument is that, as a number of legal scholars have argued, even though charter schools are defined as public schools under state statutory provisions, you know, they acted, as we point out, in many ways like private schools. So courts have occasionally held that for various types of restrictions, charter schools are not, they're not state actors. They're akin to private schools. And so the danger here is that, so what a number of these scholars are saying is that because charter schools are really private schools, then they are private with respect to school choice programs and you can't restrict them. And so that is what people are not really getting. Now, I think right now, I don't agree with where they're headed at the moment because there is this religious use, religious affiliation restriction. But if that gets removed, and there's a very good chance that it's going to get removed in the next few years, understand that, you know, Garnett was good friends with Amy Coney Barrett, new Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who was also teaching at Notre Dame. If this gets removed, then then you have religiously, then you can have charter schools teaching religion. And that's already 6% of the public school system. So I think people don't understand where we are right now. And as I said before, we're not there yet, but we could be there very shortly.
So it's pretty scary to think about the post-Espinoza endgame. But in another recent piece, you offer an alternative, and one that particularly addresses past and present racial injustices against Black Americans. In an article entitled School Finance, Race, and Reparations, which is forthcoming in the Washington and Lee Journal of Civil Rights and Social Justice, you argue for and design a school finance approach that should be included in a federal reparations program. Why, in your view, are schools a good place to consider reparations, and how would this system work?
You know, I think a lot of this started in terms of early, like work that we did many years, like in early 2000s, where we were noting that there was just this, like these racial disparities in funding that, occurred really during the separate but equal era, and this continued unabated to the present time. And so in our earlier research, we were thinking, why is this happening? And then we were making suggestions to try to stop this from occurring. What we realized is that we were writing about reparations and didn't know it. And so I think that we ended up, this time around, really trying to hone in on our prior work to try to figure out ways to get various states to address their long-going racial disparities, Black-white funding disparities, and also to create a mechanism by which the federal government can also address this. But certainly, school funding is a major area that can be addressed because there's a clear evidence of racial funding disparities, really from the separate but equal time to the present time, and where both state and federal, state level and the federal level, have really acted to create these disparities. In the research, many people have talked about school funding being an area for which there can be reparations, but they've never really kind of talked about how that would look. That was our contribution here, was to actually address how such a funding mechanism or program could look in the K-12 realm.
And to kind of peel back, what are the specifics about this, about the school funding system, about its relationship to housing segregation and discrimination and the history behind it, to try to peel that back and to point out the parts of which are really just there. It's about race. I mean, Preston was asking, we were kicking around these ideas. We would look, we'd see these racial disparities. We'd see these persistent patterns and policies and practices that led to kind of retaining racial disparities that existed pre-Brown. And we'd ask, why is this happening? And we wouldn't at that time immediately just say, oh, easy answer, racism. The literature has evolved over time. And certainly my thinking and my opportunity to work so long on this stuff with Preston and others has helped me, white dude who grew up in Vermont, just kind of see more of what's going on. When we were writing those first pieces about segregation and racial disparities in the Kansas City metro is when an author named Kevin Fox Gotham came out with an incredible book on race and real estate in the Kansas City metro, talking about how the entire housing stock of that metro area had been crafted through these racially restricted covenants governed by local homeowners associations, led by, real estate moguls like this dude, J.C. Nichols, who, by the way, his plaques and fountains honoring him on the plaza in Kansas City, Missouri, just came down this past summer. That's kind of where we've come from and to since Preston and I were writing about this, since I read Kevin Fox Gotham's book, which comes out, more than 10, 15 years before Richard Rothstein writes Color of Law, which just kind of does a deeper dive into federal policy structures and causes of these same issues. So the literature evolves, we get more and more of a base, even though all this stuff was known already, you know, by the scholars doing deep dives, but not putting it out there as publicly. So the pieces came together to very clearly identify, we identify a couple of areas in which race specifically continues to have persistent causes in school funding and you know, other kind of educational equity disparities. And that it is about race. So, you know, one, there's that issue of housing stock segregation, which, you know, is tied in with property ownership restrictions, housing policies, mortgage lending, interest rate restrictions that all lead to vast differences in accumulated wealth and property wealth, in particular accumulated in Black and white communities, whether we're talking about the Kansas City area or Connecticut. Connecticut ends up being one of our targets. And not just because, you know, Preston is living, it just happened, but Connecticut has a long history of still ongoing racially segregatory housing and property and zoning has been their big thing over the, you know, the past several years, but that's what it is everywhere. That leads to these huge differences in property wealth from Black to white communities, which in the school funding equation leads to differences in the revenue you can generate and differences in the tax, you know, these communities, Black communities that can't generate as much revenue are also taxing themselves at higher rates to not generate as much revenue. Some state school funding formulas do better than others at offsetting those wealth disparities. They do it based on measures of wealth, not on Black-white measures. Sometimes doing it on wealth alone doesn't cover the Black-white gap. So you need to think about how do we separately cover the Black-white gap. Sometimes, you know, like what we found in a number of states is that there just needs to be a more aggressive attempt to accommodate the wealth disparities. But either way, there has to be attention to that Black-white gap in wealth and how it affects school revenues.
Another point that's really important in thinking about, like, why reparations, like why school finance is such an important area for this, is that the courts, not only did the federal government play a role in terms of the redlining and other activities, but there was a period in the early 70s, in the 70s, where the federal courts could have addressed this issue. And, you know, there was the Rodriguez case, San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez, where the Supreme Court ruled that, that funding disparities for local property taxation did not violate the Equal Protection Clause. But, you know, but it's important to understand that even though Rodriguez was not necessarily thought of as a race case, you know, there was a huge racial aspect to this. In fact, one scholar called race the elephant in the room, that, you know, that race was a major aspect of this case, dealing with, you know, Mexican-American students. So there was certainly a racial aspect to this case. But then after that, you had the Milliken case, Milliken versus Bradley, where the Supreme Court ruled that courts could not include the suburbs in an urban desegregation plan. And, you know, again, like, understand that there was a school funding aspect to this, because those urban school districts were certainly not as well funded as the suburbs. But then, and finally, and in Milliken too, the Supreme Court did create a program that would provide funding as a part of the desegregation remedy. But this fund and this funding mechanism has been, Gary Orfield has referred to this as a sort of limited reparations plan, but it did not address the funding funding disparities that are baked into the our school funding system. It did not address them in the long term. It just provides short term money, and it was and then after these plans went away, then the funding went away as well. So you had this baked in disparities that have been insufficiently addressed by the federal government, by the and certainly by the court system. And it's high time that we address this, not only providing funding going forward, but addressing the harms that this lack of funding, this underfunding of Black urban areas has created over the years.
Thank you, Dr. Baker and Dr. Green. Again, their recent piece discussing reparations is entitled School Finance, Race, and Reparations, and is forthcoming in the Washington and Lee Journal of Civil Rights and Social Justice. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Lori Shepard about the Biden administration's recent decision to require standardized tests. Dr. Shepard is a distinguished professor in the School of Education at the University of Colorado Boulder. Her research focuses on psychometrics and the use and misuse of tests in educational settings. As always, thanks for listening. We hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter @NEPCTweet.